You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
When the darkness passed over the water, Taloc dreamt of the temple again, a temple far beyond the seas, ruled by an ancient queen who went to war with a race of monsters. In the dream, Taloc washed ashore on a beach at nighttime. A mere fish, unable to breathe, he slapped his tail on the sharp rocks until he felt the scales cracking. His fins strained as he tried to return to the water. His lidless eye froze stiff in its socket. And then he rose from the sand on newly formed limbs, like a crab. The claws sprouted underneath him. He opened his mouth and splayed out his gills, and the air passed through. He did not fear the light and the wind. He did not scramble back to the lapping waves, to the muted blue haze where he was born. Instead, he stood upright, no longer weightless but still strong, defying the gravity that pulled his body to the earth. He marched toward the temple, a giant mound of dirt crawling with strange creatures, each with six legs, heavily armored bodies, mouths like the claws of a lobster, soldiers bred for killing. They worked in unison, moving as Taloc's people did, many individuals forming a whole. The creatures stood in rows on each side of him. Their antenna grazed him as he walked by, inspecting his scales, his fins. His body continued to change with each step he took. The soldiers admired his new shape, with his segmented legs and a flexible shell that protected his spine, and tentacles that reached out from underneath, four new arms that could grasp or crush. Here he was no mere animal, but something more, something his people would worship, something his enemies would learn to fear. Inside the temple, he found the queen surrounded by her children. He waited for her to speak, and soon realized that she did not have to. He had understood the message ever since that first dream, and for every dream that followed. Taloc would rule, as the queen did. There would be a new era of peace to wash away the millennia of bloodshed. No longer would his people slip into the depths of Cold Trench while watching out for predators. No longer would they see their children snatched away. They would learn and adapt, and one day his people would rise from the water and find new worlds to conquer. Or they would die. The queen made him understand the starkness of it. There would be no circles of life anymore. Instead, there would be one current through the dark water, leading to conquest or extinction, life or death. And to secure life, they would not run. They would have to kill.
Robert Rapino has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. His work has appeared in the Literary Review, Night Train, Hobart, the Coachella Review, and more. He has been an editor for Oxford University Press. He's the author of the War with No Name series, which includes his first novel, Mort, the novelette, Cul-de-Sac, and his newest novel, Dark. Thank you for joining me, Robert.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a magnificent series. I'd like you to give us an idea of what we're dealing with here. Let me read a quote from Cul-de-Sac, which gives something. Dark days lay ahead. Luckily, his species could see at night. So set us up with how things evolve in the first part of Mort.
So Mort begins with I suppose, a bit of a fake-out, because it starts with the point of view of a cat who's living in a nice, quiet home. He has a safe family. He's loved. He meets a dog who lives next door and is kind of fascinated by her. But as that first chapter progresses, we start to realize, even though the cat doesn't, that things are falling apart around them, and that something terrible is really beginning to happen. There are strange reports of animals rising up with some kind of primitive intelligence, and they're wiping out the humans left and right. And by the end of the chapter, the cat himself has become bipedal. He has hands, he can talk, he can think, and he ends up killing his master. And then all hell breaks loose from there.
This is a really wonderful apocalypse. And I think one of the things that you do very well with this book is to set up the background and the science. And there is some a bit of science in here, but you build your world from a kind of set of moral precepts, and that allows you to have a novel that where the action and what happens to the characters and the character arcs all kind of allow our ways of externalizing a lot of really interesting concepts about what is intelligent, who we are, how we've treated animals, what is our place on this planet, what can happen with global warming. This is an amazing book.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It was important to use the sort of, I'll use the word trope, the sort of the tropes of an action story, because this is a story about conflict, and it is a story that sort of pushes characters to their limit. And so I wanted to have a lot of scenes in which, characters have to make a desperate, drastic choice, and that is, those choices are supposed to have consequences, and those choices are supposed to damage them. And then for the rest of the story, it affects them. It's really important, because a lot of stories that are plot-driven, you know, they'll have action scenes that are sort of filler, and I was doing my best to make it so that each action-oriented scene counted, and that, you know, they hurt our characters, and the characters had to pay a terrible price for each of them. It wasn't just like, oh, it's cool because he could use a sword and he killed this guy. Like, that can be fun too, but that's a weak action scene. A really good action scene is where the character is pushed really hard, has to make a decision, and there are serious consequences.
I think for me, by the end of the first book, I think you've done a great job at setting up a world where our sympathies and our allegiances are really liquid and fluid. We're humans, we're reading this, but when you read the perspective of Mort and the other animal characters that we meet in the first book, you realize that humans, the animals have a good reason to want to wipe us out.
Yeah, and I think that was something I had a lot of fun with in the first book, but had to sort of make even more complex for the second book. Because I think the first book, when we finally get to meet the humans, in a lot of ways they are a bit caricatured. Mm-hmm. Because they're extremists, they are superstitious, they've clearly been duped in some way. They're living up to all the stereotypes that the animals have of them. So in the dark novel, the challenge was to make things a little more diverse. So you couldn't just have all the humans acting like jerks. You had to have some of them be a little more sympathetic. One of the criticisms I got of the first book, a friendly criticism, one that I took seriously, was a lot of people were like, look, I don't think my dog would kill me. And I think my dog and I would get along if all of a sudden he was intelligent. And I had to take that seriously because, you know, there would be some animals who, even though they were drafted into this war against the humans, would be like, actually, I don't want to do this anymore. And meanwhile, there would be some humans who, even though they're completely mortified at this world, would be like, look, this is the way things go. You know, this is the world we're in now. We have to get along with these other people. I make a point to call the animals people, you know. So that was the big challenge, moving from book one to book two, I think.
Now, in between, you have a wonderful novella, Cul-de-Sac, where it follows up on Sebastian the cat. Now he's called himself Mort. He's a warrior in the Red Stripe team, which is going around tasked with they are the SEAL team.
Yeah, I should say they're Red Sphinx.
Red Sphinx.
No, I like, yes. Red Stripe team. I like that, the Jamaican beer.
Yeah, I guess I'm betraying my my beverages. One of the things I think you do so masterfully in that book is you create different races of characters, essentially, and the beavers are amazing. I just think you did such a great job with this. So talk about going through the different animal types and creating races and characters and cultures that would naturally evolve.
Yeah, well, researching them was a lot of fun, and I became obsessed with the beavers, and I've said this in other places as well, where if I had done research on the beavers early in writing this series, the whole series would have been scrapped and everything would have been about the beavers, because I love them. They're amazing animals. I guess with them, you know, I tried reading about them. I also watched this wonderful documentary. I think it was a National Geographic called Leave It to Beavers. Good title. Just about how beavers have been bred to sort of like rescue certain environments, because they, you know, they will stop up a stream and turn it into a pond, and then that pond will become a nature preserve, basically. These animals are incredible. But yeah, to answer the more general question, you know, it was important to expand the story because most of the first novel is just dogs and cats. There's a couple of side characters like a pig. But I want to talk more, not just about individual animals who are part of certain species, but how certain species would form into communities. And with the beavers, that provided a really good opportunity for that because they're sort of industrious. They're living on their own, but they've also formed a society. I wanted them to have a sort of offshoot religious practice as well. So they sing their history in a weird sort of call and response kind of way.
I love the singing beavers. It's just so, it fits so perfectly in my brain. You did such a great job. And there's also an echo of Native American culture that kind of runs through their relationship with the land. And I think you handled that very well.
Yeah, I wanted to do it even more in that direction. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the issues was I wanted to give them more like sort of Native American names, but the problem was it was hard to render a lot of those because like the really authentic ones I think are kind of difficult to read sometimes in Western, which is that's my fault. I need to educate myself more. But yeah, it was a lot of fun creating them and sort of their interaction with the sort of big city, because they view themselves as like being independent. And those people in the city, they're not having an authentic animal experience like we are. You know? they're going too human on us. I think like there's always that attitude too, where it's like the animals that are a little too close to the humans, like are somehow not as trustworthy and not as cool as, you know, characters like Cul-de-Sac, who's like a real bobcat. And, you know, right. that there's all that attitude goes throughout the whole series where it's, you know, mm-hmm. your closeness with humans, whether it was before the change or after, really determines how people look at you. You know,
one of the things I think that is interesting for me in this series is the way that this book is, I would say, at this point, somewhat close to unmakeable into a movie. But it
you don't say that too loud. But yeah,
but you write it as super cinematically, so it really plays out well. I thought that was really admirable, and the vivid and weird imagery that you create and the weird worlds you create, these are wonderful. Could talk about world building in this sense.
World building in the sense of making it so it's conducive to a cinematic
read.
Yeah, I guess. Well, first of all, I am kind of obsessed with movies, and I have to admit that they've probably had a bigger influence on my writing than actual literature, which I probably should not say very loud. But the people in my MFA program are probably like, "Oh God, this guy." But yeah, they do play a big part in it. I love the three-act structure of a screenplay. Mm-hmm. I think that it just works, and it's almost as if we've evolved to just appreciate that experience of, you know, an inciting incident, the rising action, the falling action at the end after the climax. I mean, there's something very satisfying, almost like in a primal sense about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the thing that I was aiming for was that for each of the characters to be on that path. And the big sort of air battle toward the end, the goal was for each of the characters to sort of deal with their demons, possibly rise to the occasion or fail miserably. You know, once I had that sort of locked in, I could sort of build the story around that and really just flesh things out as needed, you know. And I do some of the similar things from the first book where I sort of stop the story and just be like, okay, this is the story of this particular character and why maybe they're messed up, you know. And there was even a character in this one named Falkirk who is just a good guy.
Yeah, I like Falkirk.
Yeah, he's kind of a square.
Yeah.
And he changed a lot in the drafting process. In the earlier drafts, he was a little more passive mm-hmm. and a little more scared. And just, you know, I tried to make him a little more active. But the big challenge with him was unlike almost all the other characters, I can't just rely on the fact that he's damaged to explain everything he does. Like, oh, he was scared because of this this terrible thing happened, or he screwed up because he was still angry over this. Like, you know, with Mort's character, it's so much rage and regret. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Falkirk, he's actually a person who has, like, nobility and honor, and like it's hard to write that in an interesting way. It's almost like Superman. Like Superman can be a boring character sometimes, sure, and that was the challenge with this guy. So, but even he, once I put him on this path of sort of, you know, having a climactic moment for him both externally and internally, like that was able to, you know, that fit in with the story. Or I tried to make it anyway.
Now, this book begins with the literal creation of a new species. And I got to tell you, I really love the Sarcops. I'm a big monster hound.
Okay.
And so getting something that was like an alien with a culture and a purpose was just wonderful. Talk about creating these and why you brought them in. Were they in the original plan?
I came up with them very early in writing the Mort book.
Okay.
Because I knew that this, you know, the story, the way Mort ends sort of asks us to keep going, you mm-hmm. know. And I knew as well that there would be all sorts of side effects to the Queen's experiment to change the animals. And you know, the sea already is such a weird place. I mean, we don't know what's going on in there. And it really defies our understandings of evolution and the way animals work. I mean, the stuff that we're finding out with regard to, like, you know, certain sea creatures like cephalopods and how they experience consciousness. I mean, it's mind-boggling. But yeah, building the characters, I knew that sea creatures would really be a good way of sort of introducing the other into the story, like just something that just nobody's seen before, an abomination. Some people would admire them and some people would just think that they're just demons from hell. And that was, you know, creating them was really difficult because, you know, the first draft of the book, when my editor looked at it, he said, look, I think you need to make them even weirder. Because they were a little too human, like mm-hmm. the other, you know, you could argue that a lot of the animals in my book are already quote unquote too human. That's supposed to be one of the ironies of the book, is that they say they're rising up against the human, but really they're acting just like them. These characters needed to be even farther removed. And that was a big challenge in the drafting process. And it required a lot of work. So,
well, I love the kind of their alien perception. And I think what you do masterfully in this book is to create a situation where, as readers, our sympathies lie with Mort, with Dark, with even with the Sarcops, the humans. And so we never really, at any given moment, if we never are really certain as to who might get killed, who might, and what our reaction to that might be. That is really an interesting approach. As you wrote the book, did you know where your sympathies lied?
Where did my sympathies? I mean, I suppose they, in this particular book, they ended up moving more toward Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Because her character, a lot of her story arc involves her sort of breaking free of what's been expected of her. You know, because in the first book, she's really just kind of a prop in a lot. She's sort of MacGuffin.
Right.
You know, he's going after her. He finally finds her, but she's not what he expected.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, it's her, you know, trying to grapple with the fact that, yes, she's grateful for what Mort has done for her. She's grateful for the life that he's tried to provide for her, but she wants a lot more. And it's her decision to make. And that decision may end up hurting people, but she's her own person and she has to move forward with that. So I think by the end of the book, I definitely was sympathizing with her a lot more. But, you know, the goal in writing all these is that I think that if you're going to write a story like this, you should be able at any moment to make the antagonist the hero. And that character should be on a similar journey where, you know, they are pressed to do something. They have to make decisions. You know, they want something. They're going to go after it. According to their worldview, it makes perfect sense. They're doing the right thing. The other people are the bad guys. That's the goal I had in mind for this one. And you know, unlike the Queen of the first book, the Queen of the first book is just only in two chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So I had very limited material to work with there. This, in this case, we sort of follow them as they are developing, as they're going on a journey, as they make this decision to follow the revelations from the queen and go attack the place. Not to give too much away, but some shenanigans ensue as a result of this new species.
I think one of the things that we knew from the very beginning of the first book, and that you play out really beautifully in this book, is the relationship between Mort and Dark. Because it's a relationship that, it's this wonderful, you do this amazing love triangle. And it's really well done because Mort has some problems.
Yes.
given what the humans have done to him.
Yeah. And one of the things I was going for with their relationship was this idea that, you know, you could end up hurting people just by being yourself, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a difficult thing to grapple with because, you know, how do you apologize after that? How do you, you know, and on top of that, like, I really wanted it to sort of challenge the traditional idea of a love triangle, because what's driving the action is Dark's decision to sort of go out on her own, mm-hmm. and to not be defined by other people. And that's a very threatening thing for a lot of people, especially somebody like Mort, who in his mind, like, look, we fought all this stuff to be together. And so he actually, like, you understand why he would want to do that. But at the same time, there are moments where he comes across like a major jerk, which he can be, because, you know, you could argue that he's sort of acting as if he owns Dark, which is what this whole war was about. Nobody should be owning anybody. So there's all sorts of contradictions there that just crop up just by moving forward in your life. It's very difficult. So,
you know, when you were talking about this book about Dark and about Mort and Dark and the relationship, somebody might who just like latched into that part of the conversation might think, well, they're talking about people and it's modern 21st century novel. But we're not. We're talking about some stuff that's happening in this wild kind of fantastic world that you've set up. The thing that interests me is that the power and the feeling of as if they were humans is right there. And as you're reading, the reading experience is like reading about people. And this comes down to, I think, your ability to write really gritty and intense scenes that are where the characters are formed, and also just the descriptions of the world itself.
Yeah, and I, you know, that was a thing that I struggle with a lot, because I wanted to still throw in, I think that the book definitely goes very hard toward the human side.
Mm-hmm. But not in the humans so much. it's in the complexity of the characters you create, and those characters are reflective of their world, but in ways that we would be reflective of that world if we were living there.
Yeah, I think that's what I was going for. I think, and I think some of the moments in the story, I tried to sort of ground things in their sort of animal impulses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these animals are ruled by smell. Mm-hmm. They're also ruled by their need for companionship, because, you know, a lot of the dogs are pack animals. Mm-hmm. And the animals who used to be pets have this affection for humans, but also kind of a suspicion of them. So, there were moments where I tried to give some very strong, typically a sensory detail, to sort of ground things amidst all this other stuff you're talking about with, you know, the relationships unfolding and people having that sort of everyday human drama that we, you know, but now it's mapped into the animal world, you know.
I think it's so much fun. You do have a villainess who is now, I think she's present more often in this book than in the first book, even though in theory she's dead. But so talk about the Ant Queen. And I love this. One of the details I love is the translator that is needed for some of the animals to communicate directly with the Ant Queen, and the effect that has on them. I think that's a really interesting detail.
Yeah, I think the experience of the Queen and people's relationship with the Ant Queen, in a lot of ways, is very
similar to some, you know, experiences we might hear that could be described as religious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the queen in the second book is sort of delivering revelations to certain characters.
Right.
And that, much like using the translator in the first book, that leaves them altered.
Mm-hmm.
It allows them to have certain perceptions, but it also makes them very single-minded. You know, and you could see how that has both good effects and bad. I mean, the good effects would be that it maybe brings people together, but the bad effect is that, you know, if they're bringing them together for a cause that's clearly violent and destructive, that's no good. So you could talk about community all you want, but community that's focused toward destruction is no good. It was fun. It's actually more fun to have her in the second book because she's a looming presence. She's sort of like, you know, like, and there's an idea that she can't really die.
Right.
Several of the characters actually say that out loud. She can't die.
Yeah, so. And that's as a reader, I'm just left thinking, wow, where is this gonna go?
Yeah, good.
You do a great job of the ripping yarn aspect of this too. The action scenes are just absolutely perfectly rendered with the right amount of detail, and I think that this is a pretty short book, which is good, really, really good. Talk about de-bloating. I mean,
wait, de-bloating?
De-bloating, was this book twice as long?
Oh, you know, and this happened with both books where both Mort and Dark at one point were well over 100 pages longer than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And both my agent and my editor played a pivotal role in helping remove that. And, you know, I think the problem with them is that I'm a person who probably used too much telling, too much exposition to explain what was happening, which in my defense, I guess, is understandable because there's so much stuff that the reader is looking at that is just bizarre. And I feel the obligation to hold their hand and be like, okay, I know this is crazy, but just follow me here, okay? So the ants have done this, and they built a city like this. But really, once I had other people looking at the book, and, you know, books like this really do require a team. You know, I'd love to say like, oh, well, the genius struck me. But like, my editor, Mark Doten, is a novelist himself, and he has a lot of experience with helping focus these kinds of stories. You know, once I sort of noticed how often I was using exposition, a lot of the bloatedness went down very quickly. It was like turning the knob on a radio and getting the right frequency. Once I saw all these lines that just were not needed, that were too, you know, spoon-feeding the reader, removing them ended up being kind of a snap. And it ended up hopefully making the story a lot tighter and just, you know. And really, just to show how bloated it had become, I don't think I lost anything. Like, I didn't have to cut a giant scene or anything like that. I didn't have to remove a character. I didn't have to remove a backstory. I turned some backstories from, like, 3 pages to, like, 3 lines. But it's the same amount of information and maybe even a more compelling way.
I found that the book really, it read like lightning. It's really compelling, and it's a page-turner. And one of the things I think that interests me about the way that you write is that by what you do with the humans in this book, I think you really did a great job of, like, acknowledging, yes, we are not as easy to eradicate as the ants might hope or as we thought the ants were themselves. So talk about bringing back the human portion of this book.
Yeah, so a lot of the human sort of action in the book involves this new city that sort of sprouted up in the aftermath of Mort, of the first novel. And it's a city that has this sort of idealistic aspiration of being a city for all species. But there's an undercurrent of, yeah, it never works out that way, because what has happened is that there are a lot of humans who really do have their hearts in the right place, who feel guilty about the way that things used to be, who are really actively trying to make the world better with the animals alongside them. But then there's also a sort of cult-like presence in the city that in a lot of ways controls the real power. And they sort of serve as bodyguards of this holy figure in the city, who apparently has not been seen in a long time. So there's sort of a Wizard of Oz kind of element to the religious leader of the city. He's guarded by these elite human warriors who as the story goes on, make it quite clear that they don't like the way things have gone. They want to put things back the way they were. And I think that maps a little bit onto the real world where, you know, there are a lot of, I mean, I think your typical person probably does care a lot about making things better, but once some people get their hands on power and once they really start to think that they're somehow omnipotent or that they speak for a higher power or something like that, ooh, humans are not good with that. It just, that's what you need checks and balances for. And this new city does not have good checks and balances, I'll tell you right now.
I think that there are some really wonderful set pieces in here, and you know, scenes that that super play like a movie, and you can kind of see them set up. Did you, as you wrote, there's a scene of an attack on the Beaver City, and there's a huge and wonderful air battle, just will absolutely kick everybody's butt.
Good.
When you wrote these battles out, did you like have to map them out, like as to where things were happening?
Yeah, especially the air battle, mm-hmm. because those are the few chapters that actually, I think, bounce between one POV to another. Mm-hmm. And I had to time it so that we're with the character at that pivotal moment, but it's still working out perfectly in the sort of timeline. Mm-hmm. You know, I just watched that movie Dunkirk. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't.
I don't know if you heard about it, but it plays with time as well, whereas one person's arc takes place over a week, one person's arc takes place over a day, and one person's arc takes place over an hour, and not to give too much away, but they end up overlapping at one point. And the discipline that was involved with that was really stunning. Now, granted, I wrote Dark before I saw Dunkirk, but I definitely was trying to plan it out along those lines so that we're with each of the characters as they're sort of reaching the summit of their sort of story, mm-hmm. as they're pushed into that moment where they have to make a real decision. And really with this novel, I didn't think I was ready to start writing it until I conceived of the air battle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was supposed to be the desperate, like, you know, all bets are off. Like, we have to do this or everything's going to be destroyed. Like, that was, you know, I wanted to have that sense of dread. You know, so many stories when you're talking about these sort of dramatic scenes, the way a lot of writers will look at it is like, you know, the characters are walking along a road, they come across some bad guys, they fight, they win, they keep going across the road. And this had to be more of a collision of all the different characters and where they're headed. Mm-hmm. That's mainly what I was going for. I hope that answered your question. Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, because for me, I think one of the virtues of the book is that I really did not know from one moment to the next who was going to suffer, who was going to win. You pull some great, shocking surprises out of the hat in these battles, and I think that's really admirable. But at the same time, we never lose focus on the characters, and I think Dark is really an interesting character. So talk about dialing up her and her inner self, which I think you do really well. The balancing between her animal desires and the desires that come of being a more conscious human-like consciousness.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened here was the initial temptation was to just make her like a female version of Mort.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't really going to work because she's just been through a completely different experience. She doesn't remember the war, unlike Mort. So she's one of these people that's sort of like, oh, okay, old man, I'm sick of your stories of the war. She calls him old man as sort of like a term of endearment. So in a lot of ways, she's sort of like a teenager, whereas Mort is like a grumpy old curmudgeon, you know? So that was meant to play off each other, but that ends up becoming like the kernel of a longer sort of arc for her where she's like, you know what? I want to go see the world. I want to see everything. I don't care what the consequences are. And another thing about her that was important was that even though she wants adventure, she's not a trained killer the way Mort is.
Mm-hmm.
So when she ends up having to kill people, it's a very upsetting moment that triggers some memories of her own experience. Like she once had children, but the children were taken away from her and killed when she was before the change. So she only has a very vague memory of being a mother. And so the moments where she actually has to commit violence, she does recall those sort of vague repressed memories of what happened there. So she's a more fragile character, even though at the same time she's also much more optimistic and willing to try new things. Whereas Mort is sort of like calcified into this grumpy old guy who just wants peace and quiet. Can't you just be grateful for what we have? Why do you have to go off with this stupid Falkirk and these humans? Ugh, you want to have an adventure with them? You know, so there's a lot of that sort of, those two bumping up against each other helped to build both of them, I hope. That was the plan.
Well, yeah, he has a very Clint Eastwood-y feel.
Yeah.
There's a scene where he's kind of stepped back into the crowd wearing a sun hat.
Right.
And it's just so, it's fun, but it's also really poignant, and you totally understand why he is there. And I think that you have like a trio of characters. There's Falkirk and Dark and Mort, who are kind of your main character, but you also got Tilok?
Talik. I'm going to call him Talik, yeah.
Talik, okay. So tell us about Talik. I think he is such a fascinating character because sometimes I like him.
Yeah, I like him too. I think that opening scene that I read, you know, it sort of sets it up to be very, very ominous, where he's like, I'm coming to destroy everything. but really, he's just a normal guy trying to look out for his family in a lot of ways. But he's also torn by these strange revelations he's receiving from the queen, from this almost supernatural source to him. And that's really messing with him. And on top of that, like he genuinely cares about he has a sort of harem of mates who protect him. So it's one male surrounded by a group of females, and one of the females is sort of the lead mate, and her name is Orak. And his relationship with her
is really interesting that you could talk about the relationship between Talik and Orak when they're just like horrific aliens.
Yeah, they're Yeah.
It's super fun. And yeah. It's also poignant too.
Yeah, that was and one of the things that happens toward the end is, you know, he really, and it really happens throughout the book. It's just, you know, he has to make a choice between his loyalty and to her and his love for her and this like sacred mission that he has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was a thing that evolved over the course of the book as well. You know, originally a lot of the drama between them was just her sort of nagging him, which wasn't fair to her because she's supposed to be kind of a badass too.
Uh-huh.
So changing her. Yeah, she is. She does not mess around. And in a lot of ways, their relationship mirrors and the relationship between Mort and Dark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that there ends up becoming a moment where the four of them are sort of bonded in a way that none of them saw coming, but actually I hope works in a way, because it's people who are stuck together, you know, like people that you rely on your whole life, who you take care of each other and all that. I mean, that becomes such a part of the way you look at reality and the way you look at everything. And that's, I was trying to play with that, you know, and show that it happens even with these weird tentacle creatures that don't belong and are clear abominations, but they, you know, have their spouses who piss them off sometimes, and but they love to death, you know?
Well, I think one of the things you've really learned in this book, arguably the first science fiction novel ever written in many ways would be Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And the power of that book, which I think many subsequent writers afterwards have not ever twigged to, is sympathy for the monster. And that's where you are falling right after Mary Shelley. I mean, you take us right to that monster waking up. That's how the book begins. It's I guess in many ways it is like Frankenstein. It's Mary Shelley's monster waking up from the slab, put together from bits of leftover critters in this case.
Yeah, he is a literal Frankenstein monster, because he has like tentacles of an octopus, he has claws of a crab, he has fish like, yeah, he's all over the place. Some people have tried to draw him, by the way, and I'm just like, I don't even know what he looks like at this point. He's such a strange, like fluid kind of creature. Yeah, what would the world be like without Mary Shelley's Frankenstein? What would the world like? That is just such a pivotal moment in just our whole species imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had to do a presentation on Frankenstein at some, you know, like literary event at Bryant Park in New York, and I mean, I'm obsessed with the book as well and with the ideas in it. Yeah, and going for sympathy for that creature that not only is the other, but you could mm-hmm. argue doesn't belong, should never have even been created in the first place. But he's here now, so we got to deal with it. And, you know, that sort of almost disruption of the natural order and how, you know, how our reaction to it tells us about ourselves rather than the creature itself. I mean, that's you know, what I'm playing with here, I think.
Right. Well, I think, too, you also, we get in there's a bit of global warming.
Yes, a bit.
I think that that's one of the, you really use the science fiction tropes well to not only to work within your world, but to turn your world into a way for you to talk about things that interest you and interest us in an interesting way.
Yeah, I think the last time you and I spoke, you ended up asking me, it was a question I absolutely love, like, did you have to dial back some of the science fiction tropes and some of the action movie tropes? And I was like, oh boy, yes, I did. and yeah, I found myself doing the same thing, not learning from any of my mistakes from the first book. you know, there's a lot of, like, in this one, I think there's literally a scene where someone has to, like, basically pull a lever or put in a password and it'll destroy everything. And so there's that moment. One of the things I had to resist as far as sort of science fiction action movie tropes was the tendency for callbacks, you mm-hmm. know, where it's just like, I'm referencing the first book and I'm winking at the people who liked it. And it you know, those can be effective, but so rarely. Like, uh-huh. I can only think of a handful of callbacks that actually work. Like Godfather Part II, when Robert De Niro says, I'll make him an offer he can't refuse. That's a good callback. There are so many terrible ones in these, like, Marvel movies and these Star Wars movies and that just, like, they're just like, I get it. I get I'm watching a Star Wars movie. Thank you. I don't need another reference to Han shooting first or whatever the hell you want to talk about. So resisting those, like, I had to cut a lot of those out. This was too much. You know, that's why I need help with these books. That's why I need other people to look at them and be like, Robert, what were you thinking here? I know you had fun, but please just dial it back a little.
Now, one of the things I found myself thinking is there has got to be more to come because and if this book is extremely effective of as having seen the first book where you effectively kept us in the first book, you kept us, our attention focused mostly on the dogs and cats species. Here you break it out and you get the wolves. Oh, I can't wait to see more of the wolves. But then what you do is by virtue of what you've done as a writer, you inspire the readers to think, well, what could they be happening elsewhere? I mean, so are you going to take us elsewhere?
Yeah, I'm still working it out.
It's gotta be a challenge.
Yeah, and listen, this not to act like I'm some kind of martyr or anything, but like this Dark was a really difficult book to write.
Mm.
I never wrote more than like 1,500 words in a sitting, and typical nights involved maybe 200 words. It was like a chisel up against a giant boulder. It just wasn't coming. And even though I had it all mapped out, it's not like I was making it up as I went along. I had the story. I had it outlined. You know, I went through the trouble of doing that. But this was just so hard to write. I actually, a lot of people are making fun of me for this now. I started drinking coffee as a result of this experience. I never drank coffee before.
Really?
And I know. And now I had a night where I drank two cups of coffee back to back and was working all night long and like looked to the window and the sun was up and I was like, oh my God. So, this was just I had to like exercise more. I had to take care of myself more. So it was a very difficult book to write. Sorry, I'm getting back to your question. I swear with this third book or with this next book, I'm thinking of writing, I'm not as far along with planning it out. But I think in a lot of ways it'll be a slightly simpler story.
Mm-hmm.
And as you already figured out, the wolves are going to be trouble. you know, I need to come up with, though, I need to just map it out a little better.
Mm-hmm.
I need to just take a long trip, maybe a long train ride, just do the outline of the story and then start from there. But I have an idea about it that we're going to be still in the midst of this rebuilding of society, but there are going to be some characters like the wolves that have their own ideas, you know. And on top of that, there are some things that happen toward the end of Dark that will have a direct effect on the next story. Some of them involve Dark's decisions toward the end of the book. And those of you who read it can maybe figure that out. But, Dark is on a journey of her own, but it might get cut short because of some of the decisions she made. I guess I'll leave it at that. I don't want it to go too spoilery here, but you can figure it out. But.
Well, I think, too, the act of creation of this is so hermetic. This world is really full and feels perfect of itself. It's the kind of thing where, as with a cul-de-sac, where you just went and wrote kind of a single short rocket fire story. Do you have more cul-de-sacs that you might explore?
Well, this is actually the challenge with planning the next book, because it either could be another novella like cul-de-sac plus a novel, mm-hmm. or it could be one massive novel. Mm-hmm. The issue I'm having right now is trying to figure out if I am going to smash them together into one book, how is the novella story going to influence the rest of the bigger story? The novella story I have in mind will be the beavers, and it will be a jailbreak story.
All right.
Because, one of the beavers ends up getting into some trouble, but I didn't want to completely leave her behind because I want to learn more about her. But yeah, the hero of that story might be an old lady beaver.
Oh.
But I'm trying to still figure out how that'll play a direct role, because mm-hmm. the cul-de-sac book is more of a prequel mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And I want whatever this novella is going to be, I want it to be more directly involved with the sort of present of the story. And one thing to mention, as difficult as it was to write Dark, by the time I was done, I wrote cul-de-sac in about 2 months. And it was like a refreshing breath of air, because instead of dealing with five POVs uh-huh. and this sort of sprawling mess of a plot, it was just sort of just a simple Western.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's like a Western. It's a rockin' Western.
Yeah. And it was, and I didn't have to play, I know this is going to sound so lowbrow, but it was just, because it was more of a straight action story, I didn't have to go too into some of the bigger ideas. It's like, mm-hmm. this is a character who's angry, who has a bone to pick, who maybe has an opportunity to change the way he looks at things. And that's a lot of what cul-de-sac is about. Mm-hmm. Writing that was like a breath of fresh air after slaving over Dark for so long. Cause Dark was just, the problem with writing a five POV story is that, if you write it sequentially, you get into one character's POV, you're really moving along, chapter ends, and now you have to go to another person's POV, and you're like, oh, right, wait, I have to, oh, okay, different tone of voice. And one of my big problems with writing Dark was realizing there were several characters who would have the exact same thought. And I'm like, oh, no, why would they? Seeing that? And then it makes you paranoid. You're like, oh, my God. And now I'm, find and replace. Oh, my God. Did I do it again? Oh, my God. So it's just, very difficult experience. But made it out. I'm good.
Now, earlier on, I suggested that these would be impossible to film as movies. But actually, to be honest, that's not exactly the case. When you look at something like these Planet of the Apes movies, has there been any interest in that?
I think the what we've been hearing, mm-hmm. And this is coming mainly through my agent, and what I've been hearing is, number one, it would be very difficult to film. If we're going to do it as a live-action movie, I mean, it would be like the most expensive movie ever made. Uh-huh. So that's a bit of a problem for, an indie press book like this. Another thing, though, that's come up, and I don't know how much of a factor this is, but certainly my agent has heard it a few times. But several people have said to us, look, because you don't have a human as the main character, that's mm-hmm. going to be a problem. Having a serious film where it's the main character is an animal. Usually when you think of a story where the main character is an animal, you think of Winnie the Pooh.
Uh-huh.
You think of a children's story. You don't think of a serious story. And I think that I'm curious if someone were actually crazy enough to try to turn this into a film, would they be willing to stick with my rule of not having any human POV characters? Because I don't want any human POV characters. I want the humans to be, the humans are the aliens in my story. And they are looked, we only get to view them through the lens of these animals that resent them or fear them or in some cases love them, but in a weird way. I think the temptation will be very strong to just tell this from the perspective of a human. Because that's just what audiences expect. That's, you know, it's just the safer choice to make.
Oh, no, you don't. You couldn't possibly make that. And to be honest, as I say, when I read this, it was like more exciting to read and see in your mind. Have a, the reading experience for this was as thrilling for me as it was some many, many years ago to sit in a theater and watch the screen crawl for Star Wars. It was that kind of immersive feeling.
Thank you. Yeah, no, yeah, well, I grew up with those, so yeah, I think they, you know, even though now I'm like, oh, well, you know, Star Wars actually it's not as sophisticated as it should be, but really it's permeated everything I've done. I mean, let's just be honest here. And everybody, I mean, I'm 39 years old, so yeah, I think that the generation, yeah, it was everything. So, you know.
The new book by Robert Rapino is Dark. Thank you for joining me, Robert.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.